personal to me because I have family members who are on visa and now they are at risk of not being able to leave or enter the country.
Well, my name is Rui Kapadia and I'm from Long Island, Valley Stream.
What are your concerns for Muslims who are here already in the U.S. under a Trump administration, under this administration?
Well, I would say all my Muslims, brothers and sisters, there's nothing to fear. Your actions are more important. Keep doing what you're doing, and we are not going to do anything wrong. We are going to be unapologetic Muslims. Our country, our country, our
country. And that was Nermeen Sheikh out at JFK Airport right after President Trump was elected and imposed the Muslim ban. Nermeen, I can't wait to spend so many more years with you here at Democracy Now!, but together here in studio when this pandemic ends.
Me too, Amy. I miss being there.
Well, can't wait. Tomorrow, an hour on Democracy Now!'s 25th anniversary. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe, wear two masks.
Miss Nana now, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
Hey, bluegrass lovers. Tune in Saturday, March 13th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for a very special quarantine version of the Bluegrass Marathon from your friends at Music from the True Vine.
This year's marathon will feature homespun, socially distanced recordings from Jack Straw,
Left Coast Country,
John Cale and Andy Staninitz,
Caleb Clowder and Reeve Wilms,
Doug Sammons and Jeff Smith,
Farmstrong,
and many, many more.
Don't miss this unique radio event to catch up with your friends and neighbors, playing music and sharing stories from the lockdown.
Again, tune in to KBOO Saturday, March 13th. From 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. for the Bluegrass Marathon.
Don't miss it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... Oregonians cope with power outages in the wake of a vicious winter ice storm, as many others also suffer across the country. The wage gap persists. Women in Oregon make less money than men, but still better than the national average. And Washington is about to try to use the estate tax to push for more fairness in housing. We'll explain how that's supposed to work. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 18th, 2021. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. Portland General Electric reported that more than 100,000 customers were still without power this morning, but has hopes that the majority of those outages will be restored by this evening. The company announced today that it is expecting approximately 90% of customers will be restored with power sometime late Friday afternoon. Unfortunately, for the remaining 10%, it may take several more days to activate services, as damage from the snow and ice storm that swept through regions of the state last weekend remained, and progress to repair will take time. Maria Pope, PG&E president and CEO, said in a briefing Thursday morning that the crews will be working 24/7 through the weekend and into next week to get power restored as quickly as possible. Customers falling into the 10% margin of delayed restoration are residents in areas hardest hit by the storm, including Silverton, Canby, Woodburn, Sublimity, and Staten. Reports of people touching downed power lines have urged utility officials to warn the public to stay away from crews while they're working and to avoid removing debris if downed lines are present, especially in wet conditions. The majority of the outages were caused by wind gusts, which felled hundreds of trees, damaging equipment, power, and transmission lines, and even substations. Backup crews have been dispatched to aid in the cleanup and repair from as far away as Nevada and Montana. Portland General Electric launched a storm information page that details where crews are working in regions of the state and what current priorities are. The Clackamas County Sheriff's Office issued a warning Wednesday to those still without power to avoid using generators in their homes as an alternate heat source. Four people have died in Clackamas County of carbon monoxide poisoning caused by generators running in smaller enclosed spaces, while six residents of Gladstone were also hospitalized for much the same reason. Energy officials are urging people to only call 911 if power lines are arcing or sparking or pose immediate danger to people or pets, and to report down lines and related damages by calling PGE at 503-464-7777 or 1-800-544-1795. Its findings are pretty critical about some of the policies of the Portland Police Bureau. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade tells us about the new report that's come out from an independent citizen board that reviews the police department.
A recent audit has found that the Portland Police Bureau's policy for communicating with non-English-speaking residents to be lacking and insufficient. The audit was conducted by the city's Independent Police Review, an independent civilian oversight agency tasked by the Portland City Council to monitor and investigate allegations of misconduct by members of the PPB. Last week's audit was prompted by numerous complaints from the public regarding awkward and often misunderstood interactions between non-English-speaking Portlanders and the Bureau. Common grievances aired include people saying they were denied access to an interpreter when requested, officers relying on friends and family of non-English-speaking individuals to translate for them, and frequencies of miscommunications leaving people unclear of their legal rights. Recent U.S. Census data shows that 8% of Portlanders are not proficient in speaking English. That's roughly 50,000 residents that face language inequities when dealing with officers. Further analysis reveals that these substandard policies not only discriminate against immigrants and people of color, but the highest concentrations of people not fluent in English tend to reside in neighborhoods where officers often receive the most 911 calls. IPR investigations showed that the PPB's few bilingual officers are often dispatched to assist in communications, but that's only if they are available at that time. Additionally, those officers that may act as interpreters are not legally certified translators. They may lack the skills needed to accurately convey technical and legal concepts and are not financially compensated for their translation services. Current PPB policy states that officers are solely responsible to determine if translation services are needed to access and understand important rights and obligations at the time of contact. The audit calls these policies arbitrary and vague, stating there are no unimportant rights when it comes to the provision of public safety, and is urging the PPB to update its system to reflect federal standards that move towards outcomes that are the same as for English-speaking communities. Similar recommendations were made in 2016 when the U.S. Department of Justice's Office for Civil Rights analyzed the PPB's language services. Many of those gaps identified in 2016's investigation remain unchanged, despite a renewed attempt in November 2020 by Portland City Council that mandated all city bureaus to implement new standards regarding language access. The audit recommends PPB create clear policies on when a professional translator is needed and is suggesting the Bureau create an online portal that would help translate documents regarding constitutional rights and criminal citations for the public. PPB Chief Chuck Lavelle responded to the audit, saying he agrees with many of the recommendations but fears new implementations will be difficult, if not impossible, to carry out given the Bureau's limited budget, adding that the city or county should share the responsibility and costs involved with updating language access and translation services. With the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
Oregon reported 466 new confirmed and presumptive COVID-19 cases today and six new deaths linked to the virus. This brings the state's death toll to 2,149 people during the pandemic. There have been 151,713 cases of infection statewide. The update today includes an infant who tested positive for COVID and died the same day, the youngest patient to die in the state. Symptoms requiring urgent medical attention for kids with COVID include trouble breathing, pain or pressure in the chest that does not go away, new confusion, being unable to wake up or stay awake when not tired, and bluish lips or face. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the hospitalization of children for COVID-related illnesses is still low compared to adults. Meantime, the CDC also says that vaccine shipments across the country, including in Oregon, are delayed because of severe weather. Winter weather has affected shipments of the Moderna vaccine out of Memphis. Oregon has now given a total of more than 729,000 first and second doses of COVID-19 vaccines out of more than 922,000 doses delivered to sites across Oregon. Hospitalization rates in Oregon from COVID are on the decline. There are 169 patients in hospitals, which is 21 fewer than yesterday. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says most Oregon elementary school students will return to in-person classes by the end of April. Brown announced that more than 116,000 Oregon students have already returned to schools. She says the number of students learning in person throughout the state has doubled since December 23rd. That's when she announced that local schools and districts could decide when to bring students back to class. By April 1st, Portland Public Schools plans to offer a hybrid learning model for most of its students. Governor Brown says Oregon has received $500 million worth of federal relief money to use for new safety standards, personal protective equipment, and rapid COVID-19 tests. In the state of Washington, a bill's tax on the wealthy would aim at funding housing equity. As Eric Tegedov reports, a revision to Washington's estate tax would create an equity in housing fund.
Washington State is home to some of the wealthiest people in the country. It also is facing a housing crisis. Lawmakers may tap some of the state residents' wealth to address the issue. Legislators in Olympia are considering a bill that would revise the estate tax. It would exempt up to $2.5 million in wealth passed on generation to generation, but increase it progressively above that to 40% for estates worth more than $1 billion. Head of the Economic Opportunity Institute, John Burbank, says 10% of estate taxes would go to a newly established equity in housing fund,
which would be targeted specifically to neighborhoods and communities that are experiencing a real hurt in terms of housing, and it would be focused on rental assistance and foreclosure prevention for people living in those communities.
House Bill 1465 also would address racial wealth inequities. It's estimated the revised estate tax would generate an additional $100 million annually. Opponents argue the economy is too delicate from the pandemic to increase taxes. Another bill, HB 1406, would create a wealth tax, applying a 1% tax on assets such as stocks and bonds valued above $1 billion. Washington's billionaires have raked in more than $150 billion since the pandemic began. Burbank says, meanwhile, the state faces a large budget hole from the virus.
The pandemic sort of emphasizes the very fragility of our public services and the lack of funding for those public services, which was in fact already the case before the pandemic began.
Burbank says the tax would generate about $2.5 billion a year. He says Washington needs to provide appropriate public services to help people in need.
That will decrease the level of poverty, and it will begin to bring our state together in terms of people's incomes and hopes and aspirations and quality of life.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
Oregon women made 81% of men's earnings in 2019. That's according to the average full-time median weekly earnings measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and released today. Oregon women made an average of $836 a week, while men made $1,024 a week. That gender discrepancy ranks 18th in the nation as a whole and slightly better than the national average. Oregon women fare better on average than their counterparts in Washington and Idaho. Washingtonian women make about 78% of their male counterparts' salaries. Idaho women make around 72% compared to their male counterparts. The data is pretty broad and doesn't control for age, occupation, or education level. Additionally, the data is based on census data, so updated population counting from last year and massive economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic will likely erode the gains made in gender wage discrimination since the most recent low in 2017. Advocates of higher education have paired with a group fighting hunger. They support a bill in the Oregon legislature that aims at relieving food and housing insecurities for some college students. The Oregon Student Association, the Oregon Community College Association, and Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon are pushing lawmakers to pass House Bill 2835, which is also called the Benefits Navigator Bill. The bill would allocate funding to provide every community college and public university with a full-time staff member, whose duties would be to connect students to benefits such as SNAP, commonly referred to as food stamps, and housing assistance. In January and February 2020, Partners for a Hunger-Free Oregon, with support from the Oregon Student Association, conducted a series of on-campus listening sessions and online surveys from more than 200 students in 11 public Oregon colleges and universities. Of those who participated in the survey, more than 70% said they had faced food and housing insecurity within the previous year. Many students reported frequently skipping meals to meet rent and the inability to stay focused in class due to hunger or from lack of sleep due to long job hours needed to stay financially afloat. In a two-year pilot program started at Oregon State University in 2018, a benefits navigator position was able to bring in more than $875,000 in SNAP benefits and other resources to students, according to the Oregon Student Association. Though researchers say that on-campus hunger among students is not a new concern, repercussions from the COVID-19 pandemic have spiked economic concerns, adding even greater challenges to financially strapped students. Proponents of the bill maintain that in order for Oregon to recover from the ravages of the pandemic, statewide campus hunger and housing insecurities must be addressed by state lawmakers in this session. Parents and teachers are urged to learn more about the signs of teenagers' mental health in crisis, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Children's mental health-related visits to emergency rooms have increased since April. Lily Bolke has more on the story.
As the spread of the coronavirus continues, behavioral health experts say it's as important as ever to make sure children and young people have the mental health support they need. 19 students have died by suicide in Las Vegas since the pandemic began, and Taryn Hyatt with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention says it's critical for parents, teachers, and other folks interacting with young people to educate themselves.
Just like you would learn CPR to respond to somebody in a physical emergency, or, you know, we learn the signs of stroke and heart attack so we can be helpful. Well, we all need to learn the signs and symptoms of a mental health crisis.
She says those signs can range from depression and anxiety to withdrawing from activities or isolating themselves from family and friends. Hyatt implores anyone who may be struggling or having thoughts of suicide to connect with the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255 or the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741-741. Wendy Whitsett with the Health Plan of Nevada's Behavioral Healthcare Options notes that children are facing many of the same uncertainties adults are.
What our new normal is not being able to play with their friends in the same ways, isolation and loneliness. You know, children use their peer groups. They play just like we have our friends that we talk to.
Hyatt highlights the importance of taking signs of mental health crisis seriously, especially with children and teens. She notes the teenage brain is not fully formed yet, and young people often can act more impulsively.
That's why it is even more risky for them to be in crisis, because they don't know with life experience that this thing that seems like it will never change is going to get better.
She recommends the My3 suicide prevention app for anyone, not just people who've already made an attempt. It poses questions such as, who can you call? What can you do to distract yourself? Where is a safe space you can go? To be prepared with some strategies for coping if you do find yourself in crisis. For Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on how public schools are not making the grade to help African-American students with dyslexia. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 8, Ears in the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, we're looking at a more than 80% chance of rain and the low overnight down to 41 degrees. And tomorrow's weather, more rain on the way for Friday and a high of 49. There's still a chance of showers lingering through the weekend with highs in the low 50s. Today in history, on this date in 1885, Mark Twain published his famous and controversial novel, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, a classic tale about a boy named Huck and his friend Jim, a runaway enslaved person, and their journey down the Mississippi River on a raft. The quote of the day is from Mark Twain, who said, "The man who does not read good books has no advantage over the man who cannot read them." Mm-hmm. climate advocacy groups are praising a new bill that would ban fracking and limit oil drilling in California. As Suzanne Potter reports, the bill would put an end to all new fracking projects in the state.
Groups that fight climate change are applauding a bill introduced Tuesday to halt new permits for fracking starting next year and ban it altogether as of 2027. Senate Bill 467 also would apply to several other extraction methods that advocates say are harmful to human health and the environment. Kathy Durvin with the nonprofit 350 Bay Area Action says in order to make a dent in global warming, we need to start phasing out oil and natural gas.
California has committed ourselves to become carbon neutral by 2045. And the only way we can do that is by transitioning away from fossil fuels, including oil extraction in our own state.
Next month, the bill will be amended to require a setback to keep any new oil and gas projects at least 2,500 feet from homes, schools, healthcare facilities, dormitories, or prisons. Opponents of the bill say it could result in higher gas prices and cost industry jobs. Juan Flores is a community organizer in Kern County with the Center for Race, Poverty, and the Environment. He praises a provision in the bill that will retrain oil workers for jobs in well remediation and sealing.
By working for a just transition to a green economy, these type of jobs can grow the tax base and provide worker benefits without polluting our air and water and making people sick.
State Senator Scott Wiener, who co-authored the bill, says 2 million Californians live within 1 mile of an active well.
We must ensure that these lower income communities of color are not subject to the significant health and safety risks associated with being close to this oil production. This is a critical environmental, health, and racial justice issue.
Advocates say fracking leads to poor air quality and produces contaminated wastewater that ends up in the aquifer. Studies have found that nearby communities suffer with increased rates of asthma, congenital heart defects, respiratory complications, chronic migraines, and low birth weight babies. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Biden administration sent supplies to Texas, where millions of people are still without power. Meantime, thousands in Oregon are also without power following the devastating ice storm. Congress holds a hearing on slavery reparations. And a Kentucky County's Republican chair calls on Senator Mitch McConnell to resign. With more on these stories, here's today's edition of 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're tracking our democracy in historic times. At least 31 Americans have died in this week's winter storms. Around 160,000 people in Oregon had no power Wednesday, as did tens of thousands in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Louisiana. Hardest hit was Texas, where 3.5 million customers lost power. The White House responded with immediate support, said Press Secretary Jen Psaki.
FEMA has supplied generators to Texas and is preparing to move diesel into the state to ensure the continued availability of backup power. We are preparing to quickly process requests from other states for emergency assistance.
President Biden also voiced support for a commission to study reparations for slavery. The House panel is considering a bill to allocate $12 million to develop a proposal for remedies. Texas Democrat Sheila Jackson Lee, the bill's lead sponsor, points to a Harvard study on how Louisiana COVID infection rates would have changed if African Americans got reparation payments.
The Harvard study has reaffirmed the fact that if reparations had been implemented before COVID-19, we might not have had this definitive and deadening and deadly imbalance.
Jackson says reparations would work to lessen the racial wealth gap, which would also improve Black Americans' health. She noted slavery's impact is still felt today, such as in Ferguson, Missouri.
I went there when Michael Brown was brutally killed and racially profiled. It wasn't in 1855. It wasn't even in the 1950s. It was in the 21st century. Mr. Brown was racially profiled.
While there's growing support for reparations, particularly after last summer's racial justice protests, the bill is unlikely to pass. It would need at least 10 Republicans to advance in the Senate. Biden said Tuesday night during a CNN town hall he does not agree with Democrats like Senators Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren, who want to cancel $50,000 of student debt per borrower. Biden prefers canceling up to $10,000. Conservative radio titan Rush Limbaugh, who had more than 15 million listeners, died of lung cancer at the age of 70 Wednesday morning. Here, Limbaugh speaks about the future of the conservative movement.
I want to tell you who conservatives are. We see Americans. We see human beings. We don't see groups. We don't see victims. What we see is potential.
Limbaugh led the growth of conservative talk radio for decades, creating Republican talking points and amplifying conspiracy theories, including Trump's groundless voter fraud claims. Meanwhile, a Kentucky County GOP chair called on Senator Mitch McConnell to resign because of his area's strong Trump support. Don Thrasher said the senator, quote, stirred up a hornet's nest, end quote, with his post-trial condemnation of Trump's actions. Finally, a group of Democratic senators wrote a letter to President Biden urging him to crack down on campaign spending violations and expand voting rights protections in the next election cycle to counter Republican bills in state legislatures to restrict voting. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum.
The Fort Belknap Indian Community Police joined an important task force in Montana. U.S. lawmakers promised to work on tribal economic and business initiatives. And a federal judge temporarily stops the sale of the National Archives building in Seattle. With these stories and more, here's National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
The Montana Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force announced the Fort Belknap Indian Community became the last tribal police force in the state to join a national network of criminal justice databases. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports.
The police of the Nakota and Ani Nations are the newest law enforcement team in Montana to join the Criminal Justice Information Network, also known as CJIN. Brian Frost, missing persons specialist for the task force, says CJIN is basically a law enforcement pipeline connecting criminal justice databases from the state, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and other federal and state agencies.
So when they want sensitive criminal justice law enforcement information, or when they have an active missing persons case, they used to call Blaine County and ask Blaine County to perform those transactions for them. Now Fort Belknap will be able to do that on their own, and they won't have a third party. So that's fantastic news.
The task force also reports missing persons cases are down nearly 10% since January, after many people were found alive and well. There are 167 active missing persons cases in Montana. Nearly 32% of those missing are Indigenous. Only about 7% of Montanans are Native American. For National Native News and Report for America, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
U.S. lawmakers Wednesday speaking to members of the Native American Contractors Association during the group's annual two-day conference held virtually, pledged to work with Indian Country on economic prosperity, COVID-19 relief, and business development. Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii says he looks forward to working with tribes in his new role as chair of the Senate Committee on Indian Affairs. He says the next COVID-19 relief package has big investments for tribes and says there's likely bipartisan support in areas of tribal business and contracting.
I'm hoping that this can be a sort of relaunch of our partnership over the long run. And I'm very much looking forward to what is to come.
Congressman Don Young of Alaska discussed his role as a ranking member on the House Subcommittee for Indigenous Peoples.
And we're going to continue to work together to try to make sure that my Alaska Natives primarily, I have to be very frank with you, and American Indians of the Lower 48 can continue to go forth and be successful.
Congresswoman Deb Haaland, who's Biden's nominee for Secretary of the Interior, in a three-minute pre-recorded message, spoke about tribal economic and business initiatives, government-to-government relationships, and trust responsibilities. Thursday's agenda includes remarks from U.S. lawmakers from Montana, Nevada, Maine, and Illinois, as the Native organization sets priorities for the year and develops plans to work with the Biden administration. A federal judge temporarily stopped the sale of a National Archives building in Seattle, Washington. KNBA's Trip Krause has more.
In a written order filed Tuesday morning, U.S. District Court Judge John C. Kunauer ordered a halt to the imminent sale of the National Archives building and removal of an immense archival collection. In a news release, Washington State's Attorney General Bob Ferguson said, quote, "Today's legal victory blocks the federal government's unlawful plan to sell the archives and scatter the DNA of our region thousands of miles away," end quote. In January 2020, a five-person panel identified the archives building in Seattle and 11 other facilities as excess properties and opportunities for the federal government to cut costs. The archives building houses a collection that includes historical documents and records for 272 federally recognized tribes in Alaska, Idaho, Oregon, and Washington. A sale of the building could move the archives records as far away as Kansas City, Missouri, and Riverside, California. In January 2021, Washington State's Attorney General and 40 tribes, states, and community organizations filed a motion to block the sale of the building. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
and Diana Antonia Gonzalez.
Is there life on Mars? Or has there ever been? Scientists hope they're a step closer to finding out. This afternoon, a NASA rover landed on the planet to enthusiastic cheers from Mission Control. The multi-billion dollar machine touched down safely after a 300 million mile journey and a nerve-wracking plunge to the Martian surface. Its mission is to bring back rocks that could answer the questions about whether life has or could exist on the red planet. The rover is already sending back pictures and information. Scientists plan to land it so that it would explore a Mars crater, which once held a deep and possibly long-lived lake. Scientists believe that for Mars' first billion years or so, it was much warmer and wetter than the planet we see today. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, February 18th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Jeffrey Wade, Eric Tegedoff, Suzanne Potter, and Lily Bolke. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us for the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for an in-depth look at education and how it serves some of our African-American children.
Making contact.
This week on Making Contact, an Oakland African American matriarch fights for educational justice for the grandkids she's raising.
I said, we have a history of dyslexia. And they said, no, that wasn't the problem. That's when the fight began.
We hear about the students falling further and further behind in public school without the resources they need to learn how to read.
I'm sure if I had the resources, I could put him in a private school and he would get the help. But because I don't have the resources, I can't get the help. And so you'd be a candidate for the state prison or whatever prison there is.
Dyslexia is a language-based learning disability that affects the brain's ability to match letters with their shapes and sounds. It impacts reading, writing, and sometimes speech. Lots of states these days have laws on the books that define dyslexia, call on school districts to screen for it early, and spell out the most effective way to teach students with dyslexia to read. But California's guidelines aren't mandatory. And it turns out most districts still lag behind the science. That failure weighs heavily on low-income kids of color. Reporter Lee Romney walks us through one African-American family's struggle for educational justice in Oakland.
As for stated, I am Geraldine Robinson, and I am a fighting grandmother.
Geraldine is a devout and joyful Christian who's now raising three of her grandchildren. She's been a relentless advocate for two of them in particular.
And I am fighting for their life. It started about 6 years
ago. On this fall evening in 2019, the crowd is celebrating the 40th anniversary of a disability rights nonprofit and honoring this Oakland matriarch. Her grandson and his younger sister showed early signs of dyslexia.
About 30 years ago, I had two sons that had dyslexia, so I knew some of the signs.
Dyslexia runs in families, so Geraldine talked to the kids' teachers.
I said, we have a history of dyslexia. And they said, no, that wasn't the problem. That's when the fight began.
Research shows that even people with severe dyslexia can be taught to read. The longer the wait, though, the longer it takes. But evaluations of Geraldine's grandkids never mentioned the learning disability. Instead, they assigned the kids to a different special ed category.
Intellectually disabled.
That suggests a child is globally impaired. Low expectations often translate into fewer intensive resources to address underlying learning challenges, like dyslexia. Bias adds another twist. Nationwide, Black students are overrepresented in the category of intellectual disability, and some educators are more likely to punish Black students for falling short, even if it's clear the work is too hard for them.
My grandson, who didn't have a behavior problem, was never able to go on field trips. They wouldn't allow him because of his academics.
Tonight, though, Geraldine is feeling grateful because an advocate here at the Disability Rights Education and Defense Fund taught her exactly which law to cite to fight for her grandson.
Which changed his life because he was able to go hang out with the rest of the kids. And so that was...
The bigger news, a few months earlier, the Oakland Unified School District agreed to pay for intensive evaluations of both kids by an outside neuropsychologist.
So they were tested for dyslexia after 5 years of fighting.
As each year slipped by, Geraldine's grandsons fell further and further behind, and securing those independent evaluations wasn't the end of her fight. You'll hear more a bit later from Cheryl Thies, the education advocate who's been helping Geraldine, but she had something to say about the family that night that you should keep in mind as you follow their journey.
They're a perfect example of doing everything right and still getting nowhere. Because assumptions were made around the intersection of race and disability that these children were just low ability children.
Before we get back to Geraldine's story, I want you to get a better feel for dyslexia. It's neurobiological in origin. Anywhere from 5 to 20% of the population are believed to have it, including lots of high-achieving public figures who tell their stories to help end the stigma.
Thanks for having me. It's fun.
Thank you for being so open about this.
A few years back, Cheryl Jennings of ABC7 interviewed our now governor, Gavin Newsom, about the shame kids with dyslexia can carry. He was one of them. He dreaded reading aloud.
That moment where the clock didn't strike and I had to stand up and people start laughing. I'm shaking and I'm trying to read and I can't. You feel dumb. You feel isolated. People call you dumb.
But to really get it, it helps to go a little deeper into the dyslexic brain.
We are going to participate in a simulation today where you will experience what it's like to be in a classroom with dyslexia. Yeah, thank you.
Megan Potente is a San Francisco educational therapist and a leader of Decoding Dyslexia California, a grassroots movement of parents and educators. Her family has a history of dyslexia, just like Geraldine's. On this spring Saturday, she's using a kit developed by the Dyslexia Training Institute to blow some teachers' minds.
So for this, I will need 7 volunteers.
The first exercise is a round-robin read-aloud, typical in plenty of classrooms.
People with dyslexia see letters and words the same way those without dyslexia do. They just take an alternative neurological route to connect the letter with its appropriate sound.
But a few packets are booby-trapped to mimic what a dyslexic reader might experience.
If they read something over the something, they would improve.
Okay, thank you. We're running out of time. What did you learn?
I'm not really sure.
Student 6.
Because the dyslexic brain struggles to connect letter symbols with their sounds, it can be hard to distinguish I's from E's, P's from B's or T's, and so on. Our unlucky volunteer was working so hard to decode the text, she couldn't absorb the content. It's also hard for dyslexic students to express their thoughts or intelligence in writing. We give that a shot, too. One woman shares that she'd wanted to write, "Yesterday we drove to the hospital."
But I couldn't use all the words, so instead I just said, "Yesterday I drove, we went
in our car. Yeah. The letters changed.
So we've been doing this for a little over an hour. How would you feel if you had to experience this every day, all day long?
I wouldn't like school. I wouldn't want to go to school.
Geraldine has witnessed that pain, that shame, and she doesn't want to further stigmatize her grandkids, so we're not naming them. Even though she's been fighting hard for two of them, this story focuses mainly on her grandson, because as a black boy, it's his future, Geraldine says, she fears for the most. She's had full custody of the kids for a while now, but even as toddlers, they lived with her on and off. Her grandson showed early red flags for dyslexia.
His letters was backwards or sideways or maybe even upside down. He would have such a hard time trying to distinguish what the word was. And even with his phonics, if I pointed out the phonics, he could say it. But then when we put it to the word, he could not exactly read the word with the phonics in there.
Geraldine read to him a lot.
The Dr. Seuss books.
And the Amelia Bedelia series.
She was a busybody.
Her grandson loved wrestling, so they brought home wrestling magazines. But
after a period of time, he wouldn't even look at the magazine because it was a struggle.
Outside of those frustrations, she says, he was and is a gentle, caring kid.
If he has something, he wants everybody else to have it. He sometimes gives his away so somebody else could have it.
He's also a drummer. He started at 5 years old, and he now plays at the family's small East Oakland church.
And he almost just automatically knew how to do it. You know, he could keep a beat, you know, right off the bat.
And he's a whiz at building and repairing things. About 2 years ago, when he was 12,
a friend had bought a part for my car, and he couldn't figure out how to put it on. And he told my friend, move back. I got an idea. And he says, go get me some black tape. Grandma got some black tape. So he gets the black tape and he went in up under the hood and fixed it. And the car is still running with the way he fixed it. Just creative. You know, he can see something and create it. It's just the writing and the reading part he cannot do.
That bleeds into every school subject. Nationwide curriculum standards developed about a decade ago, for example, rely heavily on word problems to teach math.
And so you're just not doing a math problem. You're doing reading and math. He tries. He really does try, but it's a disability. And with the schools not accepting his disability the way it is, he have lost a lot of ground.
To be clear, the Oakland Unified School District didn't just abandon this boy to fail. Geraldine gave me permission to look at her grandson's records. They show he got speech therapy and was pulled out of general ed classes to get some extra help. But none of it involved the type of reading instruction that dyslexic learners need. His annual special ed documents were supposed to address his strengths, but mostly they didn't. They did spell out ambitious goals for him, year after year, but
they never achieved the goals. He's never achieved a goal.
Some teachers blamed him for his frustrations. Quote, he sulks a lot, is often angry, but will not talk about it. He rarely attempts any classwork, one fifth grade teacher wrote in an evaluation. A seventh grade teacher said he, quote, sometimes can be very difficult when it comes to his work.
Most of his teachers say that he could do better, but he doesn't apply himself. And I said, it's not that he doesn't apply himself.
His dyslexia, she says,
makes it harder for him.
When dyslexia goes unrecognized and unremediated, experts say low self-esteem, depression, and anxiety almost always follow. Geraldine says that during her grandson's seventh grade year, he was sleeping so much, she had him evaluated for narcolepsy. That wasn't the problem. Just a week before she and I first meet in April 2019, she tells me,
she came home with this headache and the shakes and the whole nine yards, where he's frustrated that he can't. And he's been like that the rest of the week, terrified and stressed.
You're listening to Geraldine's story, how public schools are failing Black students with dyslexia, on Making Contact. This program is offered for free to radio stations around the world. Check us out on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Coming up in the second half, Geraldine Robinson takes the fight for her grandson's education to the next level.
Even as the years took a toll on her grandson, though, big things were happening in Sacramento, as this early 2016 ABC7 News report notes.
There's a new law going into effect this year which acknowledges the learning disorder dyslexia in the education code.
Yeah, it will help children get access to special education and related services. You know, medical experts tell us that one in five children suffers from dyslexia. And he's
been The legislation called for experts to draft guidelines for California's public schools that would spell out best practices for teacher training, universal screening, and the type of curriculum known to work best for dyslexic learners. It's called structured literacy, and it explicitly teaches kids how to match letters with their sounds and break words into parts to read them. It works for all readers, but for dyslexic learners, it's critical. In 2017, the state released those guidelines, 125 pages long. They aren't mandatory, but still, that official acknowledgement of dyslexia likely helped Geraldine when, the following year,
I wrote a letter to the district and to the state.
It was a formal complaint, and the California Department of Education agreed the Oakland Unified School District had to assess Geraldine's grandson for dyslexia. They did. There was a problem, though. Here's Cheryl Thies, the education advocate we met at the beginning of the story.
The result of that evaluation was so poor, I mean, there is no other way to put it, and I say that as someone who has a lot of respect for people working at the school district level.
Evaluations are supposed to draw on parent and teacher interviews, class observation, and a variety of tests conducted by an educational psychologist. But a review of the district's eval, ordered by the state, shows it had none of that. Cheryl consulted a dyslexia expert who told her that the district psychologist responsible
clearly had no training in dyslexia and how to evaluate and identify it.
Rather than turn to the state guidelines or other expert sources, Cheryl's consultant noticed the district psychologist had pulled her dyslexia definitions directly from two non-scientific websites. They weren't accurate.
It also pointed to the fact that she was cutting corners.
The psychologist conducted no new tests on her grandson. Instead, the paperwork shows she relied on his previous evaluations, the ones that had stuck him with that label of intellectually disabled. And because of that, the district psychologist concluded, quote, he does not fit the profile of a student with dyslexia. Cheryl says, assuming a child with intellectual disability cannot have dyslexia or benefit from dyslexia intervention
is factually incorrect. We know from the science that those two things are not mutually exclusive.
Plus, Geraldine had contested those very evaluations. So at the next meeting to discuss the boy's special ed plan,
I just looked at the program manager and said, we're asking for an independent evaluation. And they immediately said, yes, we'll fund an independent evaluation. But it begs the question, what parent who doesn't know that there's even such a thing as the right to challenge an assessment would just go, well, that didn't seem right, but I guess they're the experts.
This point Cheryl's making is really important. How does a parent or guardian become an expert? What does it take to wield that power in a way that brings about real change for your kid? And why are some kids left behind in the first place? It turns out race and class are woven through the answers to those questions. Kareem Weaver sits on the education committee of the Oakland NAACP, and he's been playing a big role in pushing Oakland Unified to comply with the state dyslexia guidelines.
What shows up
as a racialized outcome, meaning black and brown kids aren't getting the help they need, they're not being identified, they're not giving the support, and all that's true. Really, what's behind that, as we've identified, are two gaps, an expectation gap and a resource gap.
The expectation gap, that's what leads educators to never flag a kid for a learning disability in the first place. Or it can lead school psychologists to gravitate to that label of intellectually disabled and write them off as a kid who just can't and never will.
Instead of saying, wait a second, you mean this child full of brilliance can't read by the end of first grade? There's a full scale on alert here. This is a problem. That's how you act when your kid can't read and you know they're capable of doing it.
The resource gap, it plays out this way. Federal law requires school districts to provide a free and appropriate public education in the least restrictive setting to students with disabilities. That includes students with dyslexia severe enough to affect their academic progress. Parents or guardians who believe their kids aren't being properly assessed or served, they can fight, but it's not a fair fight.
Because those who have the advocacy, those who have the money and resources to get lawyered up, to fill in the gaps where the school system did not, their kids are going to be all right.
Like this, these are private, right?
Right. Every once in a while, we do have districts that place a child at Sandhill. It's very rare, though. Very rare.
A couple of months after I first meet Geraldine, I decide to check out EdRev, a huge annual expo focused on students with learning differences. I want to get a sense of what's available to dyslexic learners, to see if there are any options for low-income families like Geraldine's. The news is not good. This administrator says districts will sometimes pay to place students at her private school, but that tends to happen only when families lawyer up. She directs me to a guy at a table down the way.
A special ed attorney.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's you don't mess with him. He is.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Interesting. Good to know. Yep.
Some schools do help subsidize tuition for families in need. Not all, though.
Do you guys do scholarships?
Not very much. It's quite negligible, quite honestly. It's a month's tuition.
There's plenty of one-on-one tutoring represented here today, too.
Yeah, we are in-home tutoring, so we don't have a center. We just send our tutors to work with families at their home.
And is it all private?
Yes.
It is. Okay.
Later in the morning, I bump into Steve Carnevale. He's a venture capitalist and big donor for dyslexia causes who founded and co-chairs the Dyslexia Center at the University of California, San Francisco. The center takes all of its research and innovations and applies it to a very fortunate group of kids from an elite private school for dyslexic students. Carnevale was once president of the board of trustees there.
And, you know, we raise $1.5 million a year that go to scholarships, but it's still a drop in the bucket. I've come to realize that the underserved populations are completely ignored. The vast majority we're not serving at all.
Geraldine is more aware of this with each passing year.
I'm sure if I had the resources, I could put him in a private school and he would get the help. But because I don't have the resources, I can't get the help. And so you'd be a candidate for the state prison or whatever prison there is.
Literacy and incarceration are correlated. A study of Texas prison inmates 2 decades ago estimated about half of them likely had dyslexia, and nearly 2/3 of them scored poorly on reading comprehension. It's such a concern that Congress 2 years ago passed a law requiring dyslexia screening for inmates in federal prisons. Geraldine knows our grandson is at risk, and he has plenty of company. Black, Latino, and Pacific Islander students in the Oakland Unified School District are 4 times more likely to be reading multiple years below grade level than white students. The NAACP's Kareem Weaver gets it. His own nephew, who went to Oakland schools, wasn't assessed for dyslexia until he wound up in the criminal justice system.
The trauma, the unnecessary trauma, to have to go to jail to be screened for dyslexia is sick as a society. So I understand Geraldine's concern. It's a real concern. The impact on her grandson's self-esteem and what that could lead to in terms of emotional stability, in terms of belief in self, in terms of you know, your capacity to guide your own path. So I know the urgency she feels.
In the fall of 2019, Geraldine gets the results from the outside neuropsychologist, the grandkids she's been fighting for so long.
Both of them had dyslexia.
Not just dyslexia. Both struggle with other learning differences too. But the independent evaluator concluded neither child meets the criteria for intellectual disability. And at last, things start to get a little better. The district moves the kids to a different school where for the first time they have access to speech-to-text and text-to-speech technology to help override their reading and writing difficulties. Geraldine tells me her grandson is particularly transformed.
They put him in a place with kids of his same level, and he's good at math, and he was able to help other kids. By the end of school year, he had a little bit more self-confidence, self-worth.
His eighth grade special ed teacher agreed. In her evaluation in March of 2020, she wrote that he'd made, quote, immense social, emotional, and academic progress. That he was, quote, an exceptional math student who, quote, always cooperates with his teachers and students alike. In science class, he'd created recycling projects and presentations on natural disasters. His teacher also happened to be one of the district's first instructors to get trained on a new structured literacy curriculum for use in special ed classrooms. Geraldine's grandson was making his way through the very first level.
The school has really been working with them, but I've been fighting for this for 6 years.
Oakland Unified declined to comment on Geraldine's case, citing privacy reasons, but a spokesman said the district, quote, is committed to providing explicit daily instruction in foundational literacy skills to students. And it looks like that's starting to happen. This past school year, the district started using a new diagnostic screening tool on its youngest students to catch problems like dyslexia early on. Kareem Weaver of the Oakland NAACP has also mounted a full-bore campaign to press the district to put a structured literacy curriculum in place for all students, not just those in special ed.
The superintendent was very clear. She agrees that we need a structured approach. We need to support kids who need foundational skills taught explicitly, directly, and systematically. That includes dyslexic students.
There is some other hope for kids just starting public school. Legislation introduced in January 2021 would require all districts statewide to screen students in kindergarten through second grade to see if they're at risk for dyslexia. Helping older kids, though, who are already way behind, that's a bigger, more expensive lift. That glowing evaluation Geraldine's grandson got from his eighth grade teacher in March 2020 noted he was reading at a third grade level. Then, 2 days later, schools closed due to the coronavirus, and they haven't opened back up yet.
The older kids can't afford a year in the tank. They're just now scratching the surface and being able to claw their way out of a hole.
The COVID school shutdown means Geraldine's grandson started ninth grade remotely. It's been rough. In fact, Geraldine says all her grandkids are losing academic ground, like so many other kids.
It's KQED News. Oakland students are among those filing a lawsuit today against the state of California and its top education leaders, alleging they're denying students an equal right to an education during the pandemic.
The Oakland Reach, a grassroots group of parents and guardians pushing to reverse generations of poor reading outcomes, joined counterparts in Los Angeles in filing that action. It contends that Black and Brown students, low-income students, unhoused students, and students with disabilities aren't getting the remote learning help they need. Geraldine's grandson checks three of those boxes. The district did give him some one-on-one help, though, starting last summer. A reading tutor who worked with him remotely.
She did make some progress, some very good progress. She was very good. She was very attentive.
But that district-funded tutoring ended in December.
I was feeling like I was getting somewhere with both of the children, and now I feel like I'm left on a cliff without a rope, you know. Now would be the time for them to get the help so they can catch up if possible. and be able to move forward, it would be right now. But without the help, they're leaving them farther and farther behind.
Geraldine says she's pressing the district to extend the tutoring. Private help would cost about $90 an hour, well beyond her budget.
This program was narrated, written, and produced by Lee Romney. You've been listening to Geraldine's story, How Public Schools Are Failing Black Students with Dyslexia, on Making Contact. Editors Lisa Morehouse and Monica Lopez. Engineer James Rollins. Show distribution, Anita Johnson. The Making Contact team is Executive Director Sonia Green. Producers Salima Hamarani, Anita Johnson, and Monica Lopez. Web updates, Sabine Blazin. And I'm Monica Lopez. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.
David R. Brower, and I add the R because there are 100 other David Browers in the United States, and that keeps me separate from most of them. I like the direction you're going in, KBOO, Portland, and I wish you had a lot more company.